Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amir Sayed Abdi, the host of the channel. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Clarissa Hyman about her book, Tomato, A Global History, which was published in 2019 by Reaction Books. Clarissa is a food and travel writer based in Manchester and a two-time winner of the Glenfiddich Food Writer of the Year Award. She's also the author of The Jewish Kitchen, Cucina Siciliana, and Oranges, A Global History. Clarissa, thanks for accepting my invitation and welcome to the show.
Thank you. And I also wrote a book called The Spanish Kitchen,
Okay, thank you for reminding me of that.
I've roamed the Mediterranean, particularly in search of interesting stories about food and travel and culture.
Okay, I hope you can tell us a bit more about that. But to start off, could you tell us a bit about your background and how you ended up as a food and travel writer and researcher? And if you could tell us about your other books as well.
Okay. I never woke up one morning and thought, I want to be a food and travel writer. I don't think anybody ever does. You know, life is just a series of coincidences and happenings, and you don't always know where it's leading you. But I actually grew up in a food world. My parents had a delicatessen shop. So I kind of grew up surrounded by food and had an early interest in food, although it was more, a question of quantity, I think, how much I was eating rather than just the quality of what I was eating, which motivated me. But at the same time, because I was in this sort of food environment, I did become conscious about, you know, what makes good food and what people want to eat and how people go about learning about food and exploring food. Anyhow, that was a very good groundwork for a later career. Before I became a food and travel writer, I actually worked in television for quite a long time as a producer and researcher. And I did several food programs, in the course of which I made a series of small films with somebody who was at the time the editor of the Good Food Guide. And we traveled around the UK eating at Granada TV's expense, which was rather wonderful. And that kind of set a pattern for me for the future, because I learned as a result of that, I was recruited as an inspector for the Good Food Guide. And I kind of, it was a big help in terms of learning how to assess food and think about food and the language in which you describe food and to sort of form comparative judgments about food. Anyhow, cut a long story short, I eventually left the world of television and I started to write, but I didn't know what to write about. And it's very hard when you can write about anything you want to, you know, what do you choose? And a friend gave me some excellent advice and said, write about something you really enjoy, you really like doing, and become a specialist in that area, because you know, that's how you'll find your own niche. And you'll also, I do believe that you write your best work if it is something that really engages you. I mean, I can be a hack. I can be a jobbing journalist. I think I could probably write about anything. But I do think if it's a subject that you are passionate about or really, you know, interested in, you know, you're going to do your best work. And I've always loved food and I've always loved eating. I mean, a lot of people say to me, well, what's my qualifications for being a food writer? And I say, oh, I'm a VGE, which is I'm a very good eater. I think it's true. I don't think you can be a food writer without enjoying your food. And in terms of travel, I've always had a curiosity about what's around the next corner. I'm not a person who, when they go on holiday, just sits on the beach and does nothing. I'm always up and about and, you know, going here, going there, looking around, you know, buildings and streets and talking to people. I don't know whether it's because I'm from the north of England. In the north of England, we are sort of known for being very outgoing and friendly and chatting. And I'm very happy, you know, sitting on a bus or in a cafe and just chatting to the next person. Whereas, that wasn't such more, but I think it's a great way, and I've come across so many stories and tales, and I mean, even when I was doing the Sicilian book, particularly, you know, I would just ask my taxi driver for a recipe, and then after a moment of surprise, they would give me a wonderful family recipe because. Fundamentally, I think everybody likes talking about food.
Exactly. And there is a very vast diversity in the books that you've written. I mean, Jewish kitchen, you know, one book on Italian cooking, one book on Spanish cooking. So what's the story behind that?
Well, I have to confess, I was asked to do them. It wasn't just, you know, that's the truth. But I don't think I'd have been asked to do them if the editors or the publishers, you know, were, you know, didn't think that I could do them. And the editor I particularly worked with for my first two books knew that I was very familiar with Jewish food, knew that I'd been to Sicily quite a lot, knew that I'd been, and then later knew that I'd been to Spain quite a lot. So, and I was also doing freelance food writing at the same time. So I was writing articles on a very wide range of food subjects for a lot of newspapers and magazines. So I think it wasn't totally random that I was asked to write these books. You know, it was on the basis that it was a sort of area, subject areas I was reasonably familiar with. But also, I think when I did the first book, there was a bit of a change going on in the food world in publishing. And I think up till then, apart from a few exceptions, on the whole, you know, a cookery book was a cookery book, was a cookery book and just had recipes. Whereas I was actually, because I'm not a cookery writer, and I wasn't trained as a chef or a cook or a caterer, and I like cooking and I do recipes, but I don't, you know, I like collecting them. I'm a sort of anthropologist when it comes to recipes rather than being a total originator. And I was more interested, I always have been, in the story, in the culture, in the experience, the lived experience behind those recipes. And I liked learning about the memories attached to the recipes or the cultural traditions that surrounded those recipes or the connection that the recipe had with the farmer or the fisherman or whatever. I can't see recipes just as a collection of ingredients on a plate. I think there is a context and a much more complicated story behind that you know, finished dish on a plate. And that's what I've always wanted to explore in my books.
That is indeed an anthropological approach. But coming to Tomato, I mean, Tomato is published as part of Reaction Books' Edible series. And for those listeners who don't know about Edible series, it's a series that focuses on the global history and culture of one type of food or beverage in each of its book. And your book, Clarissa, is on tomato. Or should I say your second book is on tomato because your first book is actually on oranges. But why tomato?
I think the... Sorry. I think, firstly, we have to agree whether we say tomato or tomato.
Yes, please settle that debate for us.
We call the whole thing off. No, I'm joking. I think the fact that tomatoes are probably the largest horticultural crop in the world today, you know, it gives them a status you just can't ignore if you're doing a series on single ingredients. I came across an interesting statistic the other day that said we now produce 182 million tons of tomatoes globally every year. And that's the equivalent of the weight of 32 Great Pyramids of Giza. So just imagine those tomatoes, you know, are laid end to end, that encircle the globe, probably. I mean, that's an extraordinary number of tomatoes.
And
given they have a relatively, you know, new history in global terms, I mean, that's an astonishing success story for this little red fruit or vegetable, whichever side you come down on. And it's certainly over the last 15 years or so, global production has just risen year on year. And I mean, it's an incredible variety of tomatoes on the market now. I mean, you know, the early producers would not recognize the tomato world today, and certainly the old Aztecs, you know, where the tomato originated, you know, would not believe it, you know. They'd be asking the gods what's happened.
Could you give us a very light version of this history that you're talking about? I mean, where is tomatoes origin? You just mentioned, but when did it become a thing? And
well, it's been a thing, I think, probably ever since the Aztecs started growing them. But although before then, they you know, came originally from South America, the sort of Andean hills and the what is Peru now today and Ecuador. And they started to become a thing with the Aztecs as you know, the seeds through various routes went northwards. The Aztecs were more keen on tomatillos, which are a similar sort of fruit/vegetable. But they then, I just have to condense the history, which is it's an extraordinary tale of a romantic tale, certainly, tale of greed and invention and rivalry and wars and exploration and you name it, the tomato story's got it. But they became a thing, really, I think around about the 17th, 18th centuries, when having traveled from the New World, the New Americas, to the Old World, and to Spain originally, where they were a bit slow in taking off. It took a while for the tomato to be established as a sort of regular foodstuff. But from Spain, they went, or the seeds at least, were taken to Italy. Again, I'm cutting a long, long tale of brigandry and smuggling and, you know, excitement and romance and poetry, and cutting it very short. And I think, again, in Italy, they struggled to be accepted initially. But once they were really domesticated and you know, started, the tomato loved the climate, the Mediterranean climate, as it turned out, and, you know, could flourish. And once gardeners, particularly the Italian gardeners, became skilled enough to know how to cultivate them properly, and once people understood that they weren't going to die if they ate a tomato, they weren't going to be poisoned, you know, they weren't going to suffer all sorts of consequences if they ate a tomato, and they learned how to use them. And because people naturally are suspicious about new things.
Yes.
Well, certainly they have been in the past. You know, what's this? And it's red and it's round and it's related to, you know, all sorts of the mandrake or, you know, poison ivy or whatever. There was all sorts of superstitions and, you know, sort of eerie, ghostly stories about the tomato. It's also felt to be an aphrodisiac. It's not. No, it did get a name, Love Apple. I mean, this is quite, you know, erroneous. But it was surrounded with myth and magic and mystery, and people were suspicious. And there's no doubt that, you know, perhaps it did have ill effects on some people because it wasn't being grown correctly and people didn't know how to cultivate it properly. They didn't know how to use it. There was a period, particularly at a time in Europe, when food was classified into humours, cold and hot aspects of food. And the tomato was felt to be a cold humour and, you know, not very good for you. People both in Spain, Italy and Northern Europe thought of the tomato more in terms of its potential medicinal qualities or its ornamental qualities in a garden. It took quite a long time for it to be incorporated into foodstuffs and into cooking. I mean, there always were people who perhaps were show-offs or sensationalists or, you know, social climbers and, oh, I've got a tomato plant in my garden and you haven't. And Cosimo de' Medici, you know, the famous Renaissance, prince, or the Medici family as a whole, they were very, very much engaged in pushing the boundaries of horticulture and gardening at the time. And they were known to have had tomatoes growing on one of their estates. And there is some documentation that they received a great big basket of tomatoes at one of the, I'm not sure which palace it arrived at in Florence. But there's no record of how they were actually used, whether they ate them. My suspicion is that they regarded this basket of strawberries. They regarded this basket of tomatoes that arrived, you know, as you would, a piece of modern art, and they would just place it, you know, on a table, yes, and all walk around and admire it. You know, it was sort of living sculpture, but we don't know. But it did take a while for it to become incorporated into everyday eating. I mean, in Spain, it was really the monasteries and the rather greedy monks of the time who explored its potential use in the kitchen. But it wasn't widespread. I mean, the other people, particularly in Spain, who would eat the tomato when it first in the 17th, 18th centuries, were just very poor people who didn't have much else to eat. And as I said, you know, as long as it didn't kill you, you could eat it. Yeah. You know, that was the sort of key thing. Although I don't think they realised it had, you know, a lot of new, you know, it was not very high in terms of its nutritive qualities. But when it went to Italy, it took a while for it to, you know, catch on as a foodstuff. I mean, again, it was either some aristocratic homes who were very keen on, you know, showing off or, saying, that we're at the forefront of fashion and we're adventurous and we can eat these things. Or it was very poor peasants who would perhaps just have a tomato with some oil, and salt and pepper, and that was it. But as time went on, particularly in Italy, it really became very, very significant in not just gastronomic terms, but in cultural and political terms as well. Mm. And it did, particularly when it met pasta, you know, this was like a marriage made in heaven. It was, and it was a very, very significant moment. I mean, tomato sauce had been developed for a while and people had known about tomato sauce. But again, you know, the whole story of when tomato sauce met pasta in southern Italy is, again, I think it's incredibly romantic and very exciting. And eventually it became a symbol of national unity after a reunification of Italy. You know, tomato sauce and pasta became, you know, the symbol of national identity. And that's really when it became a thing, as you asked.
It is.
And, yeah. I was going to say, and it eventually that spread back to the New World, when so many Italian people, impoverished Italian people, when so many impoverished Italian peasants had to emigrate to America, mm-hmm. because, you know, of both political, climate, agricultural, you know, collapse in Italy. I mean, there was a lot of famine, a lot of distress, you know, a lot of climate change. And for all sorts of reasons, a lot of Italians went to America and took their sauce with them. Mm-hmm. Although it was known, tomatoes were known in America, had been for several centuries, but the tomato sauce really, again, acquired a kind of huge symbolic presence in the diet of North Americans, you know, and the red sauce, you know, has become such a fixture that we take for granted, whether it's on spaghetti with meatballs or in the form of tomato ketchup or, you know, tomato soup. Again, the whole story of preserving tomatoes, you know, it needs a book on its own, because that's, again, I think it's a remarkable testament to human ingenuity. You know, what can you do with a tomato? Well, I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
Exactly. And there was a couple of things that you mentioned, Clarissa, that I want to follow up on. The first one you mentioned, I mean, you keep mentioning tomato sauce. So could you settle another debate for us? Is it tomato sauce? Is it ketchup? And because I guess the most common tomato product that almost every one of us have at our homes, regardless of where in the world we are, is ketchup. So how did ketchup come about? What's the difference with tomato sauce? Or are they the same?
There's an overlap. They're both ways of preserving the tomato. But tomato sauce generally is for short-term use. It's usually made with a view to consuming it, you know, fairly quickly. Tomato ketchup is about long-term preservation. And tomato sauce or tomato puree, you know, has quite a historic pedigree. Some of the first recipes about tomato sauce go back to the, you know, 16th, 17th centuries. And there are various, you know, there's so many different recipes. But it's not something particularly for long-term use, until we get to the invention of canning techniques, when you could, you know, preserve in a tin, you know, some tomato puree, for example. But ketchup, the story of ketchup comes from a different direction altogether. I mean, ketchup was something that came out of the Far East, particularly under the British colonial rule, when a lot of people who went to work and serve and fight in the East, in India and China and so on, got used to a form of vegetable preservation, which was like a pickle or, a marinated vegetable of some sort, vinegary and spicy. And when they came back to to Britain, they couldn't always find the right ingredients that they'd experienced, and would use instead something like mushrooms or anchovies in their pickle or their relish, or their ketchup, which is spelt rather differently. And so you, even now you can you can find mushroom ketchup here and so on. But it was when this way of preserving food, this relish, this condiment, went to the United States, or was taken there in people's mental recipe books, that they started to use tomatoes as a part of this making this condiment. And that became the basis for tomato ketchup. And at one time, there were many, many varieties of tomato ketchup in the States at the 20th century. And mostly, I mean, you could make it at home, but it was a long, laborious process, hours in a steamy kitchen. And, as soon as it became commercially available, why wouldn't you, buy a ready-made bottle of ketchup?
Yes.
As these things go, in terms of capitalism, I mean, invariably, there was only going to be one winner, And we all know who that was. and tomato ketchup, again, it was, in the same way that, tomato sauce needed pasta to fulfill its destiny. I'm talking American now. tomato ketchup, needed the hamburger, or the hot dog.
Yes.
Well, more the hamburger, to really come into its own. And you can't separate the two now. Where would the hamburger be without tomato ketchup?
Exactly.
Nowhere. Or very boring, And so the ketchup, most ketchup bottles last for quite a long time and are spicy and vinegary, often a bit sugary. In that sense, it varies from tomato sauce, which is not usually quite so vinegary, certainly, and perhaps will only have a little bit of sugar in. I mean, the spicing, and generally doesn't have that much spicing anymore, although now in the States, I was amazed to find that the old Aztec way of making, of using tomatoes in a kind of pounded sauce, kind of pesto, in which they also use chilies, this sort of salsa is now outsells tomato ketchup. Mexican style salsa is now bigger than ketchup, so which is a very strange circle for the tomato to be part of.
Yes. And and another thing that you mentioned earlier that I want to follow up on is that you mentioned a tomato has become kind of attached to an Italian image, and it has become a national symbol of Italy. And to this day, I meet people who think that a tomato is actually originated in Italy. And that is one of the things that you talk about in the book, which is one of my favorite parts of the book, that you argue that the history of tomato has a direct impact on, social, economic, and political forces, and vice versa. So could you elaborate a bit on that?
Because it became the tomato, once it got established, literally put down roots, particularly in southern Italy, where the reunification drive began, and you had the Risorgimento and the Garibaldi's march and so on. And the tomato was easily available. It wasn't, people knew how to use it. They knew how to cook with it. And it adapted very well to the climate and soil of the regions of southern Italy. we're not talking about the north of Italy, we're talking, you know, more about sort of Rome and Campania and Sicily and so on. And so because it grew prolifically, it was used very widely. And therefore, it was something that adapted, and because it was very colourful as well, you know, it was very much could be adopted as a national symbol, and it became something that Southern Italians were known for. I mean, they didn't know anything about tomatoes really in the north of Italy, apart from a few pockets. But this became like a sort of a something people could rally around, people could eat easily. It grew everywhere. It was cheap, accessible. Then once people started eating the tomato, they couldn't get enough of it. So it was just sort of naturally grew into this sort of iconic foodstuff that, really distinguished Italian culture and politics. And I mean, as time went on, even Mussolini, got very excited about the use of the tomato in Italian cooking. And saw it as something that, Italy could lead the world in. So it certainly has impinged on many social and political movements, even in the futurist movement later on, when they had very sort of ambivalent sort of view about the use of tomatoes and tomato sauce in Italian cooking, and they wanted to ban pasta altogether. So it's played a role at various times in the political and cultural history of Italy.
Definitely. Yeah. And could you tell us a little bit about tomato growing? I mean, there are now outdoor grown tomatoes, there are indoor grown tomatoes, there are rooftop grown tomatoes, there are tomatoes that are grown without soil, tomatoes that are ground without sun, and the list goes on. Why is there so many variation, and is there like a best way of doing it, or would any of these methods produce a better tasting tomato?
Well, that's been the holy grail for quite a long time. To grow the best tomato. But, what is the best tomato? It's what you want it for, is what you want, what are you going to use this tomato for? And so defining a good tomato or the best tomato is really intricately linked with the use it's going to have. And I mean, I think that's one of the fascinating things about tomatoes now, tomato growing now, is the range of techniques and methods, you can use, like you say. I don't think they're growing tomatoes in space now, unbelievable. There are seeds, circling us as we speak. But you're finding tomatoes growing in Iceland, for example. There's the restaurant in Iceland, which grows its own tomatoes year round using this sort of heat. There's tomatoes, as you say, being grown on the tops of buildings, vertical farms, and there's tomatoes being grown in very arid conditions or very salty conditions or very wet conditions. There is a limit though to what you're going to be able to do with it, where you're going to grow a tomato and how you're going to produce it. But I mean, the advances that have been made scientifically are absolutely mind-boggling. And now it's very much, but as I say, it's a question of what are you going to use this tomato for? I mean, do you need a tomato which basically is going to last a long time on the shelf? Do you need a tomato that is going to withstand a lot of rough handling and transporting over a long distance. You know, they grow tomatoes in Florida, beefsteak tomatoes, specifically for use in fast food joints on hamburgers, which they know they can be cut to within the millimeter of width and size to fit on top of a, you know, a quarter pound burger. Do you want a tomato which is juicy, or do you want a tomato without many seeds? How thick do you want the skin to be? How fleshy? How side? Do you want a tomato that crops all year round? Or there are so many variables. It's quite dazzling. And you know, now you've got this whole thing about the size of the tomato as well. I mean, the I was astonished to find that the cherry tomato, again, it's a relatively new marketing thing, but the cherry tomato has kind of taken over the world. It's snacks. The tomato as a snack has been a marketing triumph. It's not something that, you know, 20 years ago, people, 30 years ago, people would have thought. You might have had a tomato at a picnic, you know, a raw tomato, but you nobody would have predicted, you know, the tomato, the cherry tomato, you know, as a lunchbox snack in the way that it is now, you know, would ever happen. It's an extraordinary, you know, there's an extraordinary range of uses at growing the tomatoes. Again, it's been a fascinating story, very much linked to technology. I mean, in the first place, the tomato development really could take off in Europe, particularly Northern Europe, as a result of, you know, the introduction of glass houses and greenhouses and sheet glass, so that you could grow tomatoes, you know, sheltered from the elements, but because, you know, tomatoes aren't happy if it's very, very cold or very, very wet. You know, you could, so that, as I said before also, you know, tomato preservation, tomato canning, again, that technology really propelled the use of the tomato enormously. Technology, you know, really has helped the introduction of hydroponics, aquaponics, aeroponics, all the other ponics, you know, have only come about in the last couple of decades. But it's a scientific relation to food production, you know, has been an enormous force for good, I think. It has its downside. We've had terrible, you know, scandals. Like the great German water scandal, when, you know, the push for a massive amount of tomatoes at the lowest possible price produced a tomato that actually nobody wanted to eat and nearly destroyed the Dutch tomato industry. We've had the great scandal of GMO tomatoes, mm-hmm. Which... you know, this isn't the place to go into that. But what has come out of that is that we don't now have, I think GMO is probably, you know, a dead duck as far as, you know, horticulture is concerned. But what we do have now is gene editing and DNA sequencing, which can really improve the quality of a tomato's appearance, its taste, its disease resistance, its cropping, its growth cycles, and so on. So, you know, how do you have? There isn't one answer to how do you grow the best tomato. There are many answers because there are many purposes for the tomato.
And at the end of the book, Clarissa, you include some recipes with tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Where do these recipes come from? I mean, why did you choose those recipes in particular? Is there a story behind them? Or,
well, It's a bit random, to be honest. there was no great scheme. It was just as I went along. I did come across, you know, things which didn't fit in really anywhere else in the book, or which intrigued me to some extent, or just sort of captivated me and just caught my imagination. I just love the idea of, the tomato soup cake. You know, I thought, well, we've got to try that. You know, it just sounded so absurd and unpalatable. I thought, but in fact, it turned out to be rather good. And the fact that it had become such a huge fashionable fad, you know, in America at one period, 50s and 60s, like everybody was making tomato soup cake. I thought, well, we've got to have that. And, I suppose in a way, we have carrot cake, so maybe it's not that stupid, but it just sounded, like, oh, I've got to try that, got to include that. And I love the sound of the man-winning tomato salad. I mean, what girl could resist that? That had to go in. And what else? Oh, there's a beautiful recipe called tomate a la Lucy, which I think is the most beautiful tomato recipe in the world, and it's by a poet, a French poet, and it's like a sort of miniature but perfectly formed and described prose poem about a tomato salad recipe that is written in the most romantic way you could possibly imagine. It's really beautiful. It's only like 6 lines long. And, it describes the tomato as having cheeks on fire while the heart stays cool. And in the end, it puts the poet in, it reminds him of Scheherazade. I just thought, oh, that is so enchanting. Got to have that. And I have a family recipe, which is in there as well, for Dutch tomato soup. So, they weren't going to allow me to write the book without having that included.
And this question may sound strange to our listeners, but not to you, Clarissa. But how do you murder a tomato?
That's just a wonderful story. How to kill your tomato.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I say this to many people as I can, because I often give talks on tomatoes and oranges and whatever else I've written about. But with tomato, I have to say, the story goes that I was, I met a very nice Italian gentleman at a conference on tomatoes, and we got chatting, and he said to me, I love England, I love visiting England, but I'm always horrified when I go into an English home and I go in the kitchen and I look around, and where is the tomato? Where do you put the tomatoes? He said, you put your tomatoes in the fridge. Don't you realise you are killing your tomatoes? Tomatoes do not like the cold. And if you put your tomato fridge, destroying their flavour and their aroma and their delicious sensual qualities. So he was absolutely outraged that we would, that all the British, all they knew about tomatoes was to murder them. And he said, the saddest thing he ever saw was when he opened somebody's fridge. It sounds like an ideal guest, doesn't it?
Yes, a tomato detective.
Yeah, he opened somebody's fridge and he saw half a tomato wrapped in cling film. And he said his heart broke. So that's a warning. Do not kill your tomato. But it's true. I tell everybody now, unless they're on the point of absolutely rotting, don't put your tomatoes in the fridge. Mm.
Thank you for that note, Clarissa. And to wrap up the interview, I'd like to ask whether you're working on something right now, or are you thinking about doing a research on a particular topic in a near future?
There's no book at the moment in the pipeline, though I do have a few ideas. But I'm doing a series of articles about ingredients for a magazine I work a lot for called Food and Travel. So I'm just about to do the next two features, one of which is on sesame, which is an interesting subject, and one on coffee. I do a lot of gourmet food travel writing for this particular magazine, and recently, you know, in a gap between the lockdowns, I went to Galicia in northern Spain to do a sort of, you know, a gourmet tour, which was amazing, absolutely wonderful area for food. And I also do book reviews for the TLS, the Times Literary Supplement. So I'd like to do another book. I've done five now, and every time I come to the end of them, I think, never again, that's it. You know, no. And then I think, start to think, I think it's probably like having one another more. Baby. Yeah. Yes. Because I love getting, you know, to the root of things. I love the research. I love getting, you know, deep into a subject, because, you know, it's such an adventure writing about food. You know, you find yourself going into territory you never imagined, you know, of history, of art, of botany, of, you know, archaeology, whatever. It's such an entry into many worlds, writing about food and food and travel. So I'm beginning to get an itch.
Thank you so much, Clarissa, for coming on the show and speaking with me today and sharing your insight and your work with our listeners. I really enjoyed reading Tomato, and I really enjoyed it even more talking to you about it. So thank you very much. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.